Okay, last week we spoke about the right to privacy and the obligation of privacy that emerged from Parshas Balak, from the comment of Bilam of Matovo Olech Yaakov, and the Gemara's understanding that this was a reference to the tznius of the Jewish people, essentially. Shelo hayu pischei mechuvanu zekneged zeh, that they were not open up to each other as far as their property, and they couldn't see into each other's property. And we talked about that a little bit. We didn't get up yet to the question of listening to someone else. We spent most of the time talking about visually spying on someone else. What about listening in on someone? What about eavesdropping, wiretapping? Especially Bizman Hazah, we have the potential to do so much more in this area through electronic means than was possible once upon a time. And it makes the question much more pressing. What are the issues that are involved in that kind of privacy violation? So just to get back into the context, we had ended off talking about the fact that there is a right to privacy in terms of visual privacy. We talked last week about this concept of hezek ra'iya, of a privacy violation of someone spying on you. And in many contexts, there was a right to prevent somebody else from looking in on your property. And in addition to that, we saw that specifically citing that pasuk in last week's parasha about Tovu Alacha, when it comes to houses, it's more than a right, it seems to be an obligation. In other words, that even if the neighbors were okay with being open one to the other, that's too much. There's a prohibition already. That's a violation of the modesty standards of the Jewish people. You have to have a boundary as to privacy, even if both parties think it's okay. We're not going to let them think it's okay. And there's a requirement of privacy on that level. Now, it's an interesting question why that specific application, that we shouldn't have windows that face each other, shouldn't have doors that face each other. So we don't find today that that's really the practice, and that even in neighborhoods that were constructed specifically for religious people, we don't find that they necessarily are careful to set up the residences so that the windows don't face each other or that the doors don't face each other. So this is a discussion that a number of contemporary poskim take up. Actually, it goes back even before contemporary poskim. It's been this way for a while. And they suggest that it's really a matter of degree, that once upon a time, and certainly in the Midbar, when Bilam was making his praise, so there you have one-room residences, essentially. So if the windows faced it, if the windows faced each other, or the doors faced each other, so then you would be able to see directly into the personal area of the neighbor. But when you're dealing with contemporary residences, so usually there's a foyer, usually there are other rooms inside the house, there are doors inside the house. It's not really so easy to see inside just because the windows may face each other, the doors may face each other. Certainly the doors facing each other doesn't necessarily create visual access. And the windows, even if they face each other, so nowadays, as some of the Sfarim point out, there are window shades, the windows can be closed. They're not necessarily relied upon for light, so they're not going to be open as much as they were once upon a time. So it's much easier to maintain privacy in a contemporary dwelling than it was once upon a time, assuming they're not literally right up against each other. So we don't necessarily have the literal same rules as we would have had in the Midbar or perhaps sometime after that. So that's the assumption that many have, but of course it's a matter of degree, and it's somewhat subjective. It's still going to be that if we're really talking about a basic level of fundamental privacy, so then we do have to be careful to maintain these boundaries. And the question is going to be, just to what extent is it a reliable premise that our contemporary dwellings are fundamentally different, and when the circumstances don't necessarily fit that assumption, so then, we should assume that there are kind of absolute boundaries of privacy. So this gets us into the question of being able to overhear people. So when we consider this kind of variable aspect of it, sometimes there's absolute hezek ri'ya, sometimes there isn't. So what about when it comes to being able to listen, not to be able to see, but to be able to listen? So what you might call hezek shmi'a, so a damage that would come from listening in. So is there a concept of hezek shmi'a? So here we find a little bit of reference to this in the earlier Svarim, which both, let's say, two references that both seem to indicate that it's either not a thing or it's not a concern. So on the one hand, you have the Meiri in his commentary to Bava Basra, the beginning of Bava Basra. The Meiri writes that there is a requirement to build the house in a way that there is no visual access. And the minig is going to establish what that requires. But once you satisfy the minig, so that's enough, he says, once you satisfy the custom. And we don't worry about hezek shmi'a because we assume that people are able to prevent against being overheard. That there seems to be just a practical difference between hearing and seeing. That when it comes to seeing, we discussed last week that a big part of the consideration is how much is it possible for the other person to be able to go about their personal activities if there's too much visual exposure. Are they going to be prevented from doing what they need to do completely? Is there going to be a possibility that they still have some private space? That's all a part of the consideration. So apparently when it comes to being overheard, so it's easier to control your volume than it is to control how visible you are. We don't have the gift of invisibility, but we do have the ability to talk in a quieter fashion. So if you know that people are residing close to you, if you know that you have thin walls, so you can be expected to calibrate to that reality and to take on the responsibility for your own privacy. The idea that one should be careful not to speak in a way that one is overheard, that's something that Chazal make reference to in a few places. The expression, the walls have ears. Where does that expression come from? So as far as I know, that expression comes from a Rashi in Maseches Brachos. Rashi quotes that idea as people say, Oznaim Lakoso. The walls have ears, so you have to appreciate the fact that just because you can't see anybody listening to you doesn't mean necessarily that you have as much privacy as you might think. And therefore, that's something to take into account. So that's what the Meiri seems to be saying, that we don't have to worry about hezek shmi'a because you can assume that the parties will take on that responsibility themselves. Now, the Tshuvas of their aim of Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrachi in Simen Ches, so he writes simply that the concept of hezek shmi'a is not one that we see Chazal talking about. We see all these Gemaras we spoke about last week about hezek ri'ya. But hezek shmi'a, they don't seem to take up, so apparently that's not a concern. Now, is that a difference in formulation here? The Meiri is saying that it's something, but apparently we can assume it's taken care of. And the Re'aim saying it's not really a thing. It's probably not a significant difference. Probably they're both addressing the same kind of reality, which is that, practically speaking, we don't have the same rules for hezek shmi'a as far as hezek ri'ya. That there is a greater difficulty in giving yourself visual protection, giving yourself protection from visual prying, unless the construction of the properties is set up to protect that. So that becomes more of a factor when neighbors set up their residences. But when it comes to being overheard, so that's not necessarily something that we can insist should be factored into construction. But there are extremes. So, for example, there's one contemporary sefer, Emek HaMishpat. He has a lot of volumes on different issues of civil law, and one of his volumes is a big, thick volume on Hilchos Shchenim. So there he discusses what he thinks is an extreme case. Somebody wanted to add a balcony onto his house. His house was already pretty close to his neighbor. So he wanted to add a balcony that would make the balcony be right up against his neighbor's kitchen. So in that case, it really would be impossible for the neighbor to be in his kitchen and have a conversation that wouldn't be overheard on the balcony. So there the Emek HaMishpat writes that even though these earlier sources say we don't worry about hezek shmi'a, that's under normal circumstances. But when it's extreme, you're going to have a scenario like this where somebody in his own household is really not going to be able to have a conversation at normal volume because his neighbor lives so unusually close to him, unusually close to his central living area, so then we would say there is a hezek shmiya. So it seems like it's not really a question of kind, it's a question of degree, that just the realities are such that there's a difference between how we worry about hezek ri'ah and how we worry about hezek shmiya. But it's not that there's an absolute difference that hezek shmiya is not a concern. And certainly, what is agreed upon pretty much in all the later sources, we just have to figure out exactly how to characterize it, is that here we're talking about whether you have to set up your living area so that you're not going to inadvertently overhear conversations from other people. But if you're intentionally eavesdropping, if you are trying to spy on somebody else, so that for sure is going to be prohibited. That for sure is going to be a problem. We discussed last week that hezek ri'ah is something that manifests itself as an isser also, that there is a right of the neighbor to demand construction that will protect him visually, but there's also a prohibition to impinge on that and to try to spy on somebody else. So certainly when it comes to trying to overhear, so then there's a prohibition also. And like we said before, that technology nowadays has made it so that there are so many more intrusive ways that you can listen in on somebody else. And certainly to do that is a tremendous halachic problem. So the first question to try to figure out is, what kind of halachic problem is it? What's the source of the halachic problem? So a number of achronim assumed that, a number of the contemporaries for him that talk about this, so a lot of essays that are written about this in the modern era, again, this is something which is greatly exacerbated by technologies, it became a much bigger issue. So many point out that they feel that this is included in the Chayrim de Rabbeinu Gershom. Now Rabbeinu Gershom, 1,000 years ago, made a number of charamim, he made a number of enactments with a klala, with a curse to anyone who would violate them, and among them was that you can't read somebody else's mail. So if you can't read somebody else's mail, so then you also, presumably, these authors write, you can't listen in on their conversations either. And others, other contemporary machabrim who engaged with these machabrim who said this was included in this cherem, they said they're not so sure. They're not so sure there's really a direct comparison between the expectation of privacy that is in a letter and that which is in a conversation. And also, they don't have such confidence that you can extrapolate and assume that there's a derivation from one to the other. If the enactment was, can't read someone else's mail, we don't necessarily know to transfer that to overhearing, even to intentionally overhearing. But the difference is probably not so crucial as far as whether it's included in the cherem or not, because the prohibition is probably going to be there either way. There's a interesting discussion overall in terms of this cherem and other charamim, that when you find that there is a cherem, whether it's a cherem of Rabbeinu Gershom, what they sometimes refer to a cherem hakadmonon, when there is some kind of a ban, a curse that comes along with such an enactment, so should we infer from there that that means that until whoever it is, in this case Rabbeinu Gershom, until Rabbeinu Gershom came along, this was heter gomer, this was okay, and he came along, he created a new Israel. So that's how some understand that some sometimes infer from the existence of the cherem that before the cherem was there, whatever activity we're talking about was permitted. And others, Rav Shechter often is in this camp, assume that no, it's not what a cherem means. A cherem doesn't mean that something was permitted and then some rabbinic authority came and said, okay, from now on it's going to be prohibited. But quite the opposite, that it was something that was always prohibited, but perhaps the people were not careful about it, and therefore the rabbinic leadership said we have to make a statement, and we have to make a big fuss about it, and we have to exert social pressure on those who would violate it. And if that's the case, I think it especially fits for things maybe of this nature, things where there are prohibitions that are relevant, but they're not necessarily targeted explicit prohibitions. So one could perhaps rationalize and convince himself, okay, I'm not really dealing with something that's actually asur. And despite the fact that it is, so therefore the rabbinic leadership needs to get up and say, no, you have to appreciate that this is something that's against our Torah, even if you can't see exactly where it is. You'll say, oh, what does it say in the Torah? I can't tap phones. I read the whole Chumash, doesn't say anything about telephones, doesn't say anything about wiretapping. Seems like it's a gray area. It seems like it's open, seems like it's mutter. So the case is no, as we'll discuss, there are many prohibitions involved, but specifically because they're not necessarily explicit and targeted, so therefore, it could fall through the cracks, so one could rationalize, and therefore, it's all the more necessary for the rabbis to come and make an enactment. So it may not make a difference whether this is necessarily included in the specific Chayim of Rabbeinu Gershom, because perhaps, presumably, the Chayim of Rabbeinu Gershom itself was reflective of some other principle, of some other Torah values, and those Torah values are probably also relevant. So that's what you find in poskim that address this issue. Among them, for example, Reb Chaim Pelagi has a tshuva about this in a sefer Chikkei Lev, where he discusses the Chayim of Rabbeinu Gershom. The Chayim of Rabbeinu Gershom is found in many of the earlier Svarim. It's quoted in the Shilta Gibarim to Masach HaShvuas and many other places. But Reb Chaim Pelagi talks about what he thinks is based on, because he does work off the assumption that it's not coming out of nowhere, but that it reflects certain existing Yisurim. And whether or not you think that eavesdropping is included in the Chayim, these Yisurim, as many Svarim point out, probably do apply to eavesdropping. So in other words, either it's included in the Chayrim, or it's usher for the same reason that the Chayrim was there. One way or another, it's probably going to overlap. So what kinds of Torah prohibitions are relevant here? So on the one hand, you have the Klal Gadol B'Torah, you have Yahav Talareacha Kamocha. So we know that we are obligated to love others as we do ourselves. And there was a big discussion in the Rishonim, as beautiful as that idea is, practically speaking, what does that mean? So does that obligate us to do things positively for others the way we would want it done for us? That seems very, very daunting and very difficult. So many assume that practically speaking, the Ahavta L'Reicha Kamocha actually expresses itself as an Isser, as a negative principle, as it is articulated by Hillel in the Gemara Masech HaShabbos, Ma Da'aloch Sani L'Chevrecha Lo Savid, that which is hateful to you, you shouldn't do to others. And therefore, it means that that's an Isser, essentially. You should figure out what you wouldn't want people to do to you and understand that you're not supposed to do that to other people. So certainly, there's an assumption people don't want other people spying on them. And if you relate to that, you understand you wouldn't want somebody spying on you. You would want your privacy respected. You wouldn't want people listening in on your conversations when you don't know they're there. So too, that creates an issue. You shouldn't listen in on somebody else's conversations also. In addition, so there's also the principle of rechilus, of lashon hara. So it's interesting. How exactly do we connect this to Rechilus? So there are a number of different ways. We mentioned last week that in terms of the prohibition of Hezek Re'iyah, the Ramban in his comments to Daf Samach, Daf Mentes, in Baba Basra, so he invokes Lashon Hara in terms of Hezek Re'iyah, and he seems to be seeing it as essentially that the over-involvement in other people's affairs is something which is part of the general issue of Lashon Hara. It's part of what leads to gossip, is actual gossip. It's all a part of the overall Lashon Hara concern. But you also find some more direct relevance. So, for example, the Rambam in Hilchos Deis, when he defines Rechilus, so he understands Rechilus specifically as opposed to Lashon Hara in the more particular sense, that Lashon Hara is about disparaging someone, and Rechilus, which is together with it, Rechilus is about relating what other people are talking about. And we often understand that to mean it's you're going to rile up the person by telling somebody what people are saying about you. You go to somebody and say, this is what they're saying about you. But it's not explicit that way in the Rambam that that's what he's talking about. The Kesef Mishnah has a comment over there that could just mean that this is what we're talking about, what people are discussing. You're talking about people's private conversations, and you're relating things that are not meant to be shared with other people. And it's an erosion of trust that has a negative effect on society, and maybe that's a little bit what we're talking about here in that sense. In addition, the halachas ketanis of the Mari Chagiz, so the way he reflects it is, he says, Rechilas is tail-bearing. I'm going around taking stories and sharing them with other people. So he has a lashon there, Mali Rocha L'Acherim, Mali Rocha L'Atzmo. What difference does it make whether you're sharing the story with other people, you're sharing the story with yourself? If you are seeking out something that's not meant for your ears, and you are telling yourself that information, so then that could also be, it's the same thing essentially as Rechilas, that you're telling to a third party. You are still committing the same act, and it's included in that prohibition. And there is also a similar formulation in a contemporary sefer, Hilchos Nizkei Shcheinim, where he notes that we always assume that there's three parties in Lashon Hara. There is the speaker and the subject and the recipient. But who says you can't play two parts? Who says you can't be both the speaker and the recipient? That if you research something, so to speak, that's not your business, and tell it to yourself, you inform yourself of somebody else's secrets through your electronic eavesdropping or other kinds of hacking into somebody's email, whatever it is that you do to access information that's not meant for you, and you tell yourself that information. So you're playing two parts here. You're playing the part of the speaker and also the part of the recipient. And we talk about Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara is not only things that are negative. The Rambam defines over there in Hilchos Deis that Lashon Hara is anything that will cause anguish to the subject. So a person's private information, even if it's not negative by nature, but it's something they don't want publicized, so that's going to cause them anguish. And that would be a violation of Lashon Hara. So you're telling it to another party, it's Lashon Hara. You're telling it to yourself, it's presumably also in Lashon Hara. It's also a violation of Lashon Hara. Some point out there may be a more explicit reference in the Gemara in the beginning, and Yerushalmi in the beginning of Peah. So the Talmud Yerushalmi has its biggest cluster of sources about Lashon Hara in the beginning of Maseches Peah, and in the Bavli, it's in Maseches Erech, and you have a lot of Gemaras about Lashon Hara. In the Talmud Yerushalmi, it's in the beginning of Peah. So there, the Gemara lists off a lot of different verbs where one can be in violation of Lashon Hara, and one of them is Hayodo, or Hayodeo, so. So some understand that to mean that you make other people know something, but the way some of the commentaries understand it means that you know it yourself. So what does that mean? You know, how do you violate Lashon Hara by knowing something? So presumably it means by somehow accessing information that you weren't supposed to be accessing and making yourself know something that was not meant for your eyes or for your ears. That's included in the prohibition of Lashon Hara. There's a third iser that is also invoked here, which is interesting because literally it seems to make sense, but this isn't normally how we translate it. But some bring up the concern of Geneva's Das. So if we never heard that term before, I just translated the words, it sounds like it fits very well. You're literally stealing information. You're accessing information that's not meant for you. So that Das, that information, you're stealing it because you're taking it without rights to it. So it sounds like that's a good application. The problem is, it's not the way the Gemara uses the phrase. The Gemara in Chulin, where it has the sugya of Gnevas Das, uses Gnevas Das in a different sense. Normally it means that you create a false impression, that you take somebody's good opinion of you without earning it. That's normally how we translate Gnevas Das. But it's interesting that there may be room to also apply it differently, and here the Chikei Lev, he uses this phrase also, and he says that this is the biggest Gnevas Das, that you're taking the Matzpune Libo Chaver, you're going into the secrets of somebody else's heart. So that's a literal Gnevas Das, and that he thinks is a violation. So it sounds like one way or another to pry into somebody else's secret conversations, you're going to be either in violation of the Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom, or you'll be in violation of whatever it was that inspired the Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom to begin with, of a number of Torah concepts, which are presumably the basis for the Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom. It's going to be a violation of the Ahavta L'Reicha Kamocha, and a violation of Rechilas in many different ways, and a violation perhaps of Gnevas Das as well. So, all that being said, so, are there circumstances in which it could be justified? So theoretically, yes, but you have to discuss it very, very carefully, and let's say this with great caveats, because this is clearly a very dangerous area for a person to be murahetter to himself, one to convince himself that he's justified. So this is clearly something where there's great delicacy and a lot of counterbalancing factors, but just to discuss theoretically, so Oshkim assume that if you believe somebody poses a danger to you, so then there's what to talk about, whether what to listen to somebody else talking about, perhaps. So the Chidkei Leiv talks about that in his discussion of reading somebody else's mail. So there he assumes that if somebody is actually coming to hurt you, so then Rabbeinu Gershom was never goes there in that case. So you have to also fit it into all the various Dinim Daraisa that we said inspire the concept, but he takes it as a given that you could assume that the Chayrim doesn't apply when somebody is going to hurt you. A later postgame, contemporary Mechaber who discussed this, they emphasized, like we were trying to stress before, that you have to really have a very strong basis to believe that somebody really poses a very real danger to you, because this is clearly something that one could abuse very easily based on very spurious reasoning. So it's a theoretical kind of justification, but it's not something that we would be too quick to utilize, because there's clearly a tremendous violation here. It's very interesting that Yitzchak Zilberstein, in his Sefer on Baba Basra, in his Chashukei Chemet, so he has a discussion which seems like it's the same discussion twice, but it's slightly different, and I think there's a significant difference between the two. So in the Sugya of Hezekri in the beginning of Baba Basra, and the Sugya of Hezekri later, and Daf Mentes and Daf Samach, so he discusses in both places taping somebody else, recording somebody else. Nowadays, this we don't call it taping anymore, but they're recording somebody else's conversation without their knowledge. And there's a crucial nuance between the two discussions, even though after that, the discussion is pretty much identical. But I think it plays out very differently. So basically, in one place, he discusses, can you electronically eavesdrop on somebody, like we've been talking about? And in the other place, he discusses, can you tape a conversation, can you record a conversation that you're a part of, and the other person knows you're a party to the conversation, but doesn't know you're recording it? So he asks those two questions in the two different places. And after posing the question, he has essentially the same discussion in both places, or it looks like it's the same discussion in both places. He says that there's a violation here of Gnei Vistas and of Behavta L'Recha Kamocha and of Rechilos, but it theoretically could be justified if the person poses a danger to you. So those words sound the same in both discussions, but I would posit, I would assume that the consideration, the analysis is very different, even if the components are the same. Because we can understand that the intrusion of listening to a conversation where the person doesn't know that you're there at all is a much greater intrusion than recording a conversation that you are a party to and the other person just doesn't know that you're recording it. So they're both problematic, and like you said, they're both violations of Yahavta L'Reach Kamocha. In both cases, you wouldn't want somebody doing it to you. And it's not nice, but they're not the same in degree. And to illustrate how different they are in degree, so let's say by American law, so am I allowed to, if I'm a party to a conversation, can I record that conversation without the other party knowing? So the answer is, it actually depends what state you live in. Different states have different laws about this, so you have to know where you live or where the conversation is taking place in order to know whether this is legal or not. And yet, to tap somebody else's phone, so that for sure you can't do unless you have the Patriot Act or unless you're the FBI, you have a warrant or something like that. If you're not a party to the conversation, so for sure you're not allowed to do it. So clearly there's a big difference between the two, even if we assume they're both not the nicest thing in the world, but there's a much greater violation and intrusion involved in recording a conversation that the person doesn't know you're there at all than in recording a conversation where the person does know you're there and just doesn't know you're recording it. In that case, so the other party knows already that you're listening and knows that you're hearing what's being said and knows that you have the physical possibility of repeating what you heard to somebody else. The only difference of the recording is that you're going to have more credibility and more accuracy if you play the recording. But it would seem like the issues would basically be the same with or without the recording, that if the conversation is one that you're not allowed to repeat, then you can't repeat it without the recording. If it's one that the person wouldn't mind having shared, so then the recording doesn't really make much of a difference. All the recording does is make it undeniable and more accurate. So you could understand why in American law there's a significant distinction between that, because the other party doesn't necessarily have a right to not have that aspect given to you, the accuracy and the reliability. So in some states, yes, in some states, no, but it's different. So for Zilberstein to essentially give the same components to each discussion, it might be the case, but I would imagine that the threshold is different, that the, like we said, you should be very, very careful before rationalizing and being murder hetter in any of this area. It's a very serious intrusion. But I would imagine that the threshold for danger that would be required to listen in a conversation you're not a party to would be much, much higher than the threshold necessary to record a conversation without the other person's knowledge when they do know you're there. Wouldn't, the second one is also not nice, is not necessarily the friendliest thing to do, but that might be necessary for protection. So presumably the threshold, even if the basic math, the equation is the same in both, but the threshold in terms of how the factors are weighted are presumably very different. There is also an extensive discussion. There was an article about this by Rav Shlomo Daichovsky in the journal Truman, and then there was also an article by Rav Lezer Shenkelovitz who quoted and discussed some of Daichovsky's points, where they both discussed what about after the fact. So let's say there was a recording that was made, and let's assume that it wasn't proper, but once the recording exists, so would a Bez Din rely on such a recording? So first of all, would you assume that it has to be disqualified as kind of a mitzvah babi avera or yavi lo mahani, like you would have in American law, would be a fruit of the poison tree? So should we assume that you have to throw out evidence that's illegally obtained, or is there some room to distinguish? So there's a very extensive discussion about this, specifically in Rav Daichovsky's discussion, where he considers all the factors, and whether or not in an American court, for example, a recording would even be admissible is a question. It's also a question he discusses there, whether a Beis Din should rely on a recording, whether you can assume you can recognize somebody's voice. These are side issues. These are important issues, but that's a different component of it. But maybe it could play a different role, even if it's not absolutely reliable, but would it have any space as far as being evidence in a Beis Din proceeding? So that there's a lot of factors to consider, and among them, the issue of if it was obtained under illegitimate circumstances, so how much should that play a role in disqualifying it as potentially a source of testimony? There's a fascinating and very surprising svara there that Daichovsky considers there. Again, he's talking after the fact, but one of the issues he was talking about is in a divorce case. It was a recording that was being used as evidence, and he raises the possibility that maybe there's a different dynamic between spouses, that whatever expectation of privacy there is between two random people, it's not necessarily the same when you're dealing with spouses, and that maybe that's something you can see from the ksuba, or not even from the ksuba, but from the tnoim. That the tnoim, if you sign the tnoim, not everybody has tnoim anymore, but the tnoim that are sometimes signed at the wedding has a language, al yavrichu, al yalimu, lo zemizav, lo zemizuv, lo mzumizav. They're not going to hide anything from each other, not going to conceal anything. So he discusses, is there some kind of a expectation that there's a completely open relationship between spouses? So Shenkelovitz, he discusses that. He thinks that that's a very hard to say, and that even to the extent that it's true, it's still true maybe in a stam, but if there's a desire for privacy, so then that would reassert itself differently, and you shouldn't assume that there should be any difference. That's a very interesting consideration that was brought up and that was argued about in this conversation And especially, specifically, the question of after the fact, is there any kind of a difference in terms of how these things would be assessed? So that was a back and forth debate. Again, it's quite a machodesh idea, but certainly v'chachila. What you have here is a very strong agreement that to listen in on somebody else's conversations, whether you're doing it just by straining your ear or by using electronic devices, would certainly be a violation of many great Torah values, and perhaps also a Cheirim de Rabbeinu Gershom, and certainly all kinds of Midos and Dinim of the Torah itself. And it would only be justifiable in terms of preventing great harm or great need, which would theoretically override it, a great kind of toelus. And that's also relevant to another aspect of privacy and confidentiality. So what if we only have half the problem? Let's say it's something that you're entitled to know. Let's say somebody told you something knowingly, but you're not supposed to reveal it. So what's involved in, what prohibitions are involved in revealing something that was told to you in confidence? Even if you didn't spy on anyone in order to find it out the first time, but you were told it by somebody directly, but now you're revealing it without their permission. So that's a very important practical issue, just to say a few words about it. The Gemara in the beginning of Maseches Yoma has a drasha based on the pasuk in the beginning of Sefer Vayikra that you should assume if anyone tells you anything, you should assume that it is begeder baltomer. You should assume that it's something you're not allowed to repeat until they actually tell you leymor, like the drasha from the pasuk there, until they say this is something leymor, this is something you can repeat, unless you're told you can repeat it, you should assume that it is considered to be confidential and you shouldn't repeat it. You should always take a default attitude that whatever you're told can't be repeated without permission. So this is a discussion in the Rishonim. Is that an actual din? Is that a Midas Chasidus? Many consider that to be a Midas Chasidus. It sounds a little bit from the way the Smag brings it that he thinks it's actually a din min haTorah. That's how the Torah Tamima reads the Smag, but he disagrees with the Smag. He says he thinks still it's asmachta. It's not really the Pashat, the message of the Pasuk. So he thinks it's an asmachta. Many think that it's a Midas Chasidus. But that's talking about the default attitude, the assumption that anything anyone tells you, you should treat as confidential. Okay, so maybe that's Amidas Chasidus. But if it's clear that something is confidential, if the person tells you it's confidential, or the context is obviously something that is not the kind of thing somebody would want to share, so then there is an absolute prohibition to repeat it without their permission, and that's included in the prohibition of Lashon Hara for all the reasons we said before. And also the pasuk in Mishlei that identifies this with Rechilas. The pasuk says, Cholech Rachel Magal Asod, which is an interesting question. Does that mean to say it is Rechilas? So this is the Midah of a Rochel, but just like he speaks Lashon Hara, he also reveals secrets. But one way or another, there's an Isser here of Gilui Sod, which is included in the general family of Rechilas. And so that should be taken as a prohibition as well. And so to reveal something that was told to you in confidence, if it's clear that it's in confidence, so then it's more than a Midas Chasidus, that's an Isser of Gilui Sod. But there also, so there are sometimes other considerations. So especially since it's under the rubric of Lashon Hara. So we know that when it comes to Lashon Hara, so there is also a counterbalancing value of Toelah. Sometimes there's a need to reveal something if it's going to protect the innocent, if somebody could come to harm if this is not revealed. So then the same principle of Toelah, which justifies and obligates Lashon Hara sometimes, so too it should apply also to Gilui Sod, but again with very serious waiting, something waiting as in giving it weight, making sure that it's analyzed carefully. You know, the Chafetz Chaim is a whole list of conditions as to when you decide something as to, well, it's not a decision you come to lightly. But theoretically, the basis of Toelis, the justification of Toelis, would apply here also, and that's something to factor in and something that has to be considered very heavily. So sometimes we have to just worry about the issue of Gili Sod and have the consideration of whether there's enough Toelis to justify it. Sometimes it's a big professional issue. So if somebody is a therapist or a doctor or a lawyer, and if you hear something in confidence, so then it's also an ethical issue. What about their professional considerations? So does that change the dynamic at all? So that's a discussion extensively in Poskim. Zilberstein has a letter from the earlier writings where he talks about the Hippocratic Oath, and he talks about whether, if there's a professional oath, does that create a shvua that puts an additional isser that one should not reveal things if that's the assumption of the prohibition, that there's an obligation of confidentiality in the profession if one takes a professional oath. So does that have a din of a shvua? So that he didn't think was necessarily the factor, because if there is a mitzvah to reveal whatever it is, if there's some kind of losam al dam reacha, so then a shvua would not be allowed to override that issue. So he didn't think necessarily that the shvua was a consideration, but there could be other considerations as well, such as what if one will lose his professional license if he reveals whatever it is. So how much is that a factor? So that was a major discussion with Rabbi Yosef as a tshuva about this, and Eliezer as a tshuva about this, Rabbi Nachum Rabinowitz as a tshuva about this, and a sefer Siach Nachum. So it's a very clearly a very chomer issue, which has to be considered on a case-by-case basis. But one of the considerations, if one is going to have to give up his whole parnasa because he's going to lose his license in order to fulfill the mandate of Losamad al-Dam Reacha, so that's a discussion that both can have on the surface at Talav. Should we say that you have to give up your whole parnasa, maybe you have to give up all your money in order not to violate a lav? So that's a discussion. There's some who are machalik. They say that even though we assume, like the Rambam writes, that losamad al dam reacha doesn't just mean don't be passive when somebody's going to die, like the pasuk sounds, al dam reacha, but we understand it to mean any kind of harm, whether it's material or physical or spiritual, of any degree, there is a yeser of losamad al dam reacha. But in terms of how far you have to go, so some of the posts can assume that to give up your whole livelihood, that is only if it's really literally somebody's going to die. It's actually dam reacha in the literal sense. So then you'd have to give up your whole livelihood in order to stop that from happening. But if it's just part of the broader application of losamad al dam reacha, any kind of harm, so then you have a right to cheshbon how much of a price you have to pay in order to do that. The price is not only monetary also. So the question is, let's say if you're a doctor, you're helping people, and you're not going to be able to help anyone if you lose your license for sure, but also even if you're not going to lose your license, but let's say you know that it becomes known that there's no protection of confidentiality, and anyone who's going to come to you is not going to be able to be treated with the expectation of privacy, so that's going to mean you can't help anyone else. That's also a consideration that posts can talk about, and it's again a very serious issue which has to be considered very carefully on a case-by-case basis. So there's a lot to think about. We've started the 3 weeks. The 3 weeks are a time when all kind of considerations of Lashon Hara are very much front and center. The Chofetz Chaim writes in his Sefer that when Chazal say that Sinas Chinam was the cause of the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, he says they mean Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara and Sinas Chinam are the same for these purposes. So to that extent, we have to be particularly aware of issues of Lashon Hara during the Tkufa all year round, but certainly during the Tkufa, and even this extended umbrella of Lashon Hara that talks about issues of privacy and confidentiality is within that heading, and is also something that we need to give special attention to. So as we proceed within the 3 weeks, something to think about. God willing, next week and the week after, we'll probably do things that are even more related to issues of the 3 weeks. But for now, just to quickly recap, we saw that the Hezek Shmia is different in degree, really, probably rather than kind, from Hezek Riyo. But certainly there is a concern for privacy in terms of being overheard, and certainly a prohibition for intentional eavesdropping, whether that prohibition is a function of the Cherim or and still there can sometimes potentially be other kinds of considerations and how exactly that factors in itself for discussion, and even things that you know better, but you're asked not to repeat them. There's a default in general to be careful not to repeat things you don't have explicit permission, but there's certainly an isser if you know that it's confidential. But there also, so there could be toelis considerations and losan vel dam reacha considerations, and we went through a few of those possibilities of how exactly that plays out. So I wish you a good night. I wish you a kiyum of the bracha of Matovo Halacha Yaakov in the positive sense. And we should continue to internalize all of these sensitivities that should allow this period of the 3 weeks to accomplish everything it needs to, so that it should no longer be a tkufa of crying and mourning. And I look forward, Baruch Hashem, to seeing you next week. Have a great night.